nanohub.org. You can follow along with this presentation using printed slides from the NanoHub. Visit www.nanohub.org and download the PDF file containing the slides for this presentation. Enjoy the show.
Last couple of days, couple of lectures, we have been talking about a rather special device which I was using really to convey this concept of entropy. And the special device consisted of one where one contact only injected upspins and the other only injected downspins. And so you have upspin and downspin electrons inside the channel, but no current can flow ordinarily unless they interact with an impurity and flip their spins. And then we had this interesting situation where if you could arrange all the impurity spins to be up, for example, then what would happen is downspin electrons would be able to flip by interacting with an upspin impurity and go from right to left, but upspin electrons wouldn't be able to go from left to right. And so you kind of produced a unidirectional situation. And we discussed how you could have current flow in a device like that, just taking energy from the surroundings, essentially. And what was really driving it is this concept, is this thing about entropy, namely that you're starting out with a very special situation where all impurities are up. And if you have n impurities, all of them can be up in only one way. There's only one way to arrange n things, so they're all up. On the other hand, by the time you finish, they are all random, some up, some down. And that can happen in 2 to the power n ways. This, if you look at all the possible ways of arranging impurities, that would come to 2 to the power n. And what is driving this process then is going from here to here. And this is an example that kind of illustrates this point about entropy very clearly, because no energy is involved in this exchange. Often what happens is energy exchange is also involved, and so these two things kind of get mixed up a little bit. And what I want to talk about today is this general rule that applies when energy exchange is involved, actually. See? And here, but the main point to remember from here is that things can be driven by entropy rather than by mechanical forces. Entropy simply meaning that the initial state is just one, while the final state is like thousands. That's what is driving it, really. Okay? Now, the example I want to talk about today is actually a very simple one that you all kind of understand, have seen, and that is, think of a device with just two levels. You know, an energy epsilon 1 and energy epsilon 2. Yeah, this could be like a hydrogen atom, for example, or anything with just two levels. Now, left to itself, what we all know is, and we don't worry about spin or anything in this discussion, we just got one electron in here. And the question is, left to itself, how will the electron distribute? And you might have thought that it would be half up and half down. After all, there are two states there. But not really. What we all know is that it will go to the lower energy state. Right? That's almost like you've heard it enough that you don't question it. But I sometimes do get that question from beginning students, you know, beginning undergraduates is, you know, just why does it always go down? You see, by the time you become a graduate student, I guess you don't ask silly questions like that. But the thing is, yeah, it is really, if you think about it, there's no simple answer to that one. You know, why does it always go to the lowest energy state? You know, this kind of understood in our thinking. And that certainly doesn't come from Schrodinger equation. You see, if you take Schrodinger equation, you know, and with two levels, you could write it in terms of, say, you know, psi 1 and psi 2. You could use these two as your basis functions conceptually and write Schrodinger equation like a matrix equation, which would look something like this. And You could say that, well, no, when because of all the coupling to the surroundings, because of the phonons, photons, whatever it is coupled to, this thing feels some electric field, which produces some coupling between the two levels. So that if it is up here, the electron, it wants to come down. But the point is that any such field due to the surroundings, whatever you put there, you'll put the same thing there. And so if it takes you from 2 to 1, it'll also take you from 1 to 2. And so if you really solve that with some random force here, you'd come to the conclusion that it's up and down equally, which would be completely wrong, of course. As you know, it will be distributed, I guess, according to Fermi function. And if this energy difference is much bigger than kT, you know, say 1 electron volt or 0.5 electron volt, then basically the result is that the electron will be down here and not up there at all. That's it. And the question is, how do I include that into my equation so that, you know, I can describe devices where things like this are involved? You see, so far we have kind of bypassed that question. We have said that, you know, we are going to talk about devices where electrons just go straight through. No energy exchange. And then at the end, the contacts will take care of the energy thing. And that's how you kind of bypass that whole issue. You see, that's what, in a way, that's why I say that small devices are actually easier to understand than big devices. Because big devices means all this kind of thing will be happening inside the device, lots of it. Whereas small devices means it's a good approximation to say that just happens at the ends. And then you can take care of it easily by simply saying that through mechanisms that we won't get into, the contacts will always be maintained with Fermi functions, where electrons are always maintained with the distribution given by a Fermi function. So done. Okay? That's what you have done for most of the course, really. Right. Okay. So the question is then, why does it always go down rather than up? Or rather, in general, why does it go down more easily than up? And the point is, this also, in a way, is an entropy-driven thing. You see? And let me make this clear. Why? The idea is that this thing is not isolated. If you had something that was isolated, then it would probably just stay wherever you put it. That's it. If you put it in an eigenstate, generally it would just stay there. But the thing is, it's not isolated. It's coupled to the surroundings. And when it's coupled to the surroundings, let's say this is the energy of the reservoir, the surroundings that we are talking about. And reservoir at a certain energy has some number of states. You could call it the density of states of that reservoir. And this is what I mentioned earlier, that entropy is like this logarithm of that. Right? This is the expression we had written down last day, remember? And for large reservoirs, as I mentioned, one of the important results is that, I mean, what you would, of course, intuitively expect is if you add energy to a reservoir, the entropy goes up. Why? Because if you give it more energy, more and more states become accessible. At zero temperature, if you have very little energy, then it goes to the lowest state. Okay. Now, so the important result is that if you plot S or W versus E, the thing is, here it will always be an increasing function of E. The more energy you give it, the more the number of states that are accessible. So you could call this axis W or S, whatever you like. And as I had mentioned last day, for reservoirs in equilibrium, dSdE, that is the amount of by which the entropy changes due to a change in energy, is 1 over the temp. I mean, that actually is the thermodynamic definition of what is the temperature of something. It is related to how much its entropy can change when you add some energy to it. Okay. Now, the reason this is relevant here is, the way you think about it is, okay, why is it that it's easier to go down than up? And the argument would be something like this. That supposing when an electron is up here, and the reservoir has an energy, let's say somewhere here. And the two are together, and this electron's there, that's its energy, the reservoir has this energy. Now, electron goes down, so the reservoir takes up the energy. Overall, of course, energy is conserved. So when the electron's down here, reservoirs up there.
Now the point is that all normal reservoirs will have an increasing density of states. So there will be a lot more states here than here. So although we think that we are talking about transition from one state to another, what you're really talking about is a transition between this many states and that many states. In the sense, when the electron is there, the reservoir has, let's say, just a few states like this. No, maybe, say, 10 of them. Whereas when the electron is down here, the reservoir is up there, and that's like 10,000 states. You see? So, roughly. And so why is it easier to go down? Well, that's because there's 10,000 of them there. I mean, the same thing that why this thing was being driven from here to there. You see? Now, the thing is, in this case, the example we did last day, the interaction was purely elastic. And ordinarily, what would happen is the impurities would be in this state and there's no energy involved, and Fd would be equal to Fu. And there would be nothing driving it. And the reason we were seeing an entropic force there was, I said, well, if you could create a situation where all the impurities were up, then it would be driven one way. That's what we talk. But here, even at equilibrium, the point is there's always this driving thing. There's this energy exchange involved. And the point is that any reservoir always has a lot more states at this energy than here. And so effectively, you're going from few states to lots of states. And so a general property here is that whenever you are trying to give out energy to a reservoir, that means you're trying to come down. So I'll call that, say, D of minus epsilon. By the way, this D has nothing to do with density of states. I'm using this D. Yes, maybe I'll just use a capital F like I had here. Just use capital F here. The only thing is that in the notes I handed out today, there is this, what I put on the, what's on the second page is just the changes that you need to make to the NEGF equations in order to handle inelastic scattering. That is, on the first page, the equations that you'll see, these are things that you have seen before. Nothing's changed. I haven't changed anything there. These are all the same equations. Only thing is, if you look at the second page, previously I had said that, you know, if you just want to put in some amount of elastic scattering, you just put sigma equals dg. And some of the homework problems you have done just that. Now, if you want to put in inelastic scattering, then what happens is things get coupled. That is, sigma at one energy comes from g at another energy, kind of. And the resulting equations, that's what's given here, right below that. And that's something I'll try to discuss next lecture. We'll probably not get to it today. So, but the point is that here, there is this d of plus epsilon and d of minus epsilon that describes the scattering process. And the only problem with that is that it might get confused with density of states. And as I said, it's got really nothing to do with density of states. Okay? So that's why I'm kind of hesitating between what to use. Okay, let me just use d of minus epsilon with the understanding that I won't use d for density of states in this discussion at all. Okay. So the point is that if you have a process that involves losing energy, that means giving energy to a reservoir. So the strength of that, let's call it d of minus epsilon. And if you consider a process in which you're gaining energy, that is, you're pulling energy out of the reservoir, that would be d of plus epsilon. Right? So the plus and the minus refer to what happens to the system. In other words, when you see minus, it means the system is losing energy. So that means you are kind of coming down. And this ratio, then, what you might expect is, you see, when you're losing energy, you're going to all these lots of states here, whereas when you're gaining energy, you're going to this few states. And so this ratio will always be bigger than one. And the ratio you could write as, you could say, well, how many states do I have, W? I just move this over. at E plus epsilon divided by how many states do you have at E. So if you look at what is the number of reservoir states at energy E and how many at E plus epsilon. So then you could say the rate at which you give up energy and the rate at which you take energy from the reservoir will be in that ratio. Okay. And the thing is, from this definition, you can see that W is exponential S over K. So I could write this as E to the power S of E plus epsilon minus S of E divided by K. Okay? Because the W is E to the power S. Okay? And again, for large reservoirs, this entropy difference you could write as, you know, like this Taylor series, that is E to the power ds dE times epsilon over K. Okay. So the difference in S you could write as the derivatives times the how much it changed. Okay. And thing is, ds dE of course is 1 over the temperature of the reservoir. So this then becomes T. So the bottom line is, to any normal reservoir, it is a whole lot easier to give energy to it than to take from it. And the ratio of how much of this ratio of this giving to taking would be E to the power epsilon over KT. So what that means is that in general, when trying to write the current in a structure like this, you see, previously I had written this down when we had elastic scattering. Now you might say, well, for elastic scattering means epsilon is zero. So rate at which you give energy or take energy should be equal, essentially. Okay. And indeed, at equilibrium, that would be the case. You see, those spins at equilibrium, those two things would have been equal. The only reason we were having unusual situations where, like this, was because this is a rather non-equilibrium situation for those impurities. I mean, a bunch of impurities wouldn't be all up for no good reason. Right? They would be random generally. Okay. But the point is that in general then, if you are going from some energy E to some other energy, say E minus epsilon, which means you're losing energy, then that would be multiplied by some factor here that would be minus epsilon. And the reverse process where you're going from E minus epsilon onto E will have a D of plus epsilon. So in general, for inelastic processes, where your system is interacting with the surroundings to either give up energy to it or take energy from it, the point is there will be something that this D of minus epsilon and D of plus epsilon. And of course, if the reservoir is out of equilibrium or is, you know, some strange thing, then there is no necessary connection between those two. But if it is something in equilibrium with some temperature T, then it will always have that ratio. That's the point. And that ratio comes simply from the fact that you always have a lot more states up here than down here. Now, this point, I want to stress a little bit here that sometimes, you know, you might think that, well, what I have in this axis is like density of states. Why does it always have to increase? Because after all, as you know, in 1D conductors, for example, we say that the density of states in a 1D conductor versus energy in a 1D waveguide would actually go like this. It is actually E to the power minus half. You know, one of the results I'm sure you have seen in 606 or elsewhere is that 1D conductor is e to the power minus half. 2D, it's e to the power 0. 3D, it's e to the power plus half, etc.
So you might say, well, maybe we can arrange for a reservoir whose density of states doesn't increase like this. And then you would be, from this argument, you would be expecting all kinds of strange results. And that's kind of true, that if you really could arrange a reservoir which goes the other way, there could be strange results. It's just that it's not quite so easy. And the reason is this. This is just what you call the one particle density of states. So when you write S equals K ln W, the thing is you should think of that W as the number of states of that entire composite system. You see, the reservoir is composed of, say, 10,000 particles. So the W is like how many ways those 10,000 things could be arranged, which is not what this is about. This is about just one electron, you see. So what I mean by that is like this 2 to the power n. It's like each one can be up or down, but with n things, the total number of ways in which they can be arranged is 2 to the power n, you see. And so what happens is, if you, for example, have one material with, say, W1 states and another with, say, W2 states, and now you think of the whole thing as one, question is, how many states do you have? Well, if you think in ordinary one electron terms, you'd say, well, density of states should just add up. You know, you got W1 here, W2 there, you add them up. But not really. This W is about the composite thing. So the total number of states is actually W1 times W2. Because every way of arranging this can be paired with something up there. See? And so, when you bring two things together, the entropy actually adds because of the logarithmic function. As you realize, logarithm of W1, W2 is like logarithm of W1 plus logarithm of W2. So one could almost argue that you needed a logarithmic function just from that argument. See, because that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. See? And one point that you learn in thermodynamics courses is that it is exactly this entropy that drives the flow of heat. For example, if you have, say, this is E, this is S. If you have two things with two different temperatures, then one of them, let's say, looks like this, and the other one, say, looks like this. Now, this is the one with the bigger DSDE. So this is big. So that is small. So this is the cold one. And this is the hot one. Now, what we all know, of course, is that heat goes from hot to cold. Now, from an entropy point of view, the way you could argue is the following. That supposing, originally, you have this much energy in the hot thing and this much energy in the cold thing. And we bring them together. And so, let's say, what we are trying to figure out is, will the hot one pick up some energy and go up while this one goes down, or will it go the other way, or will it do this? You see? So, of course, total energy is conserved. So if this goes up, this has to go down. Whereas if this goes down, that has to go up. Now the question is, which one will happen? And the argument is that the hot one will actually lose energy and the cold one will get it, which means this is what will happen. And the reason is that the hot one loses some energy, and so its entropy goes down a little bit. But the cold one gains the same amount of energy, and its entropy goes up a whole lot more. Why? Because its slope is bigger. You see? So overall, then, the entropy has gone up. Whereas if you had done it the other way, then it wouldn't have worked. Then the overall entropy would have gone down. So this is the kind of argument you'd see in the thermodynamics texts and all that. And there's lots of things in real life that are basically driven by just this kind of thing, that entropy has to go up. And it's very important then to recognize that when you write S equals K ln W, that W really has to do with the states of that whole thing in this sense. You know, where you have, if you have W1 states here and W2 states there, it's the product that we are talking about. So, for example, if we think about, let's say, a box with n electrons. Question is, how would you write down the W, the density of states? Now, what we have done always is, this one electron thing where, let me take this off, where, as you know, as I said, that for 1D, it's e to the power minus a half, 2D, it's e to the power 0, 3D, it's e to the power plus half. Now, where does this come from? Now, the fastest way to do this is, like, you know, the way you count states in K space. That is, you say that the number of states is proportional to, in 1D, it is proportional to K to the power 1. In 2D, it's proportional to K square. 3D, proportional to K cubed. And since energy is proportional to K square, this actually comes to e to the power plus half. This is proportional to e to the power 1. This is like e to the power 3 halves. So if you count in K space, like how many states you have up to a given energy E, then in one dimension you'll get e to the power a half, two dimensions you'll get e to the power 1, three dimensions you get e to the power 3 halves. Now, how do you get the density of states out of that? You take the derivative, because density of states means that I'm looking at the number of states up to some energy E, and now let me say I increase the energy a little bit. Question is, how many extra states do I pick up? So I need the derivative of this. And then you can see e to the power half will give you e to the power minus half, 1 will give you 0, 3 halves will give you half. Right? So that's the quick way to see why, how you get this. Now the point is, what would you expect then if you had n electrons? And the thing is, what you're now talking about is as if it's a 3n dimensional vector, right? Because each electron could have kx, ky, kz, and then there's n of them. So what you could do is, you could then say that the total number would be like e to the power 3n over 2. And so the corresponding density of states would be like e to the power 3n over 2 minus 1. And that minus 1, of course, is not terribly important when you're talking of huge numbers. So the point is, then this would be like what you'd call the density of states. Okay? So, or the W. So let us say W then is equal to some constant times e to the power 3n over 2 minus 1. Some constant which I really don't need. That's why I'm not even bothering to talk about it. So that's W. So if I now take ln W, that would be like S over K. That would be ln of alpha plus and so if I take ds de, what do we get? I don't get anything from the first term, that's out. And then what I get is 3n over 2 minus 1 divided by E. Which is approximately equal to, I guess there's 1 over K here. Which is approximately equal to 1 divided by 2E over 3n. Now, what you'll notice is that what you have in the denominator is like the total energy per electron. And one of the results of statistical mechanics is that if you have this reservoir full of many electrons, then at equilibrium, the average energy would be like half kT per degree of freedom. So this is what would become like half kT. See? And that is how you'd then get dS over dE equals 1 over T. Right? So those details I don't want to get into, right? But if you take a course in statistical mechanics, for example, you'd go through different models where people show you how the entropy, this dSdE, becomes like 1 over temperature. Right? All these different things. Now, but the main point I wanted to make here is how to think about the W. Because in a way, it's density of states. It is just that it's not the density of states we have been talking about most of this course. You know, like every day, I usually draw a density of states here. But that's the one electron density of states, which is like that e to the power plus half or so at most. Whereas this density of states is really when you think of this whole thing as one big thing. That's the point. And that is one of the things, like in the last couple of weeks of this course, I'll talk more about. And that is this many electron picture, the picture where you think of the whole system as one big thing. See? And because there are many problems where that picture is needed or is important. Okay. Now, actually, this basic thing leads to the central law of equilibrium. As I said, if you took a course in statistical mechanics, and it's usually focused on equilibrium statistical mechanics, this law is like the central thing. In other words, you'd spend most of the course either deriving this law or applying it. I mean, this is the central thing, you see? And the basic law is the following. It says that at equilibrium, the probability that the electron will be, that the system will have a certain energy E is proportional to this E to the power minus E over kT. So it is. So if you want, if you have all kinds of states with different energies EI, then the probability the system will be in state I will be proportional to this. Now, if you want to put an equality, then what you have to do is make sure that all the probabilities add up to 1. So what you then do is, I mean, you have to divide it by some constant to make sure that some pi summed over all I is equal to 1. And that's the condition that will basically determine what that constant is. But the basic result is the probability will always be proportional to this. And this kind of comes from, again, this basic idea that any system, whatever it is, if it is in contact with a reservoir, then the system can always give out energy much easier than it can take in energy, this ratio. This ratio for any normal reservoir would be e to the power epsilon over kT. So what that means is, if you think of this system as, let's say we are talking of two states. You know, one of them is E1, other is E2. Now, since it's a lot easier to come down than to go up, you can expect that the ratio of, that it will be a ratio of occupation of this level compared to that will always be this e to the power minus e over kT. So this is almost a consequence of that, really. And the point to note is that the system itself can be small, like it doesn't matter if it's a nanoscale structure. It could be very complicated, all kinds of interacting things. That's fine, because the property really comes from the fact that it is in contact with an ordinary-looking normal reservoir. And because all normal, ordinary-looking reservoirs will have this basic property, that giving up energy to it is easier than taking energy from it by that ratio. And that would then lead to this. Now, one modification I need to make to this, let me just do it at this stage, and that is that so far I've been talking about a situation where this system exchanges only energy with the surroundings. So what that means is it could be, say, emitting light, emitting phonons, where energy is involved. But in general, it could also be losing electrons to the surroundings. So for example, like what happens at this contact. So when an electron goes out, some amount of energy goes out, but at the same time, an electron also goes out, you see? Now, if you want to include that, so in other words, this is the law that would apply if a system had a constant number of particles, constant number of electrons. But if the number of electrons can also change, if all these different states we are talking about could involves different numbers of electrons, then you should modify this to look like the following. I mean, that's it. That instead of E, you should use E minus mu n. Now, of course, if all the states you're interested in have the same n, then that's not an important thing, because then that's just a constant. You don't have to worry. On the other hand, if you want to compare the probability of different states with different n's, then it's important to include that. And that comes from the fact, again, that here also, when you're exchanging energy, if that involves particles, then you should actually include a mu here. Now, where does that come from? Well, the quickest way I know to see this is that if we are, let's say, an electron actually goes out into this reservoir, and the reservoir is in contact with a battery or something that maintains a constant mu, then what happens is anytime an electron comes in with some energy epsilon, another one goes out here in order to keep the number of electrons here the same. And so the amount of energy that actually goes in there is like epsilon minus mu. That would be the simple argument for why instead of epsilon, we use epsilon minus mu. Okay. So this is the generalized version then, that if, of course, only energy exchange is involved, then you don't put this in, then you drop that. If energy and electron exchange are both involved, then you should include that. Okay. That's it. Okay. Now, one thing you can see right away, and let me just show this, is that, as I said, this is the basic law of equilibrium. And all these different versions that you see are kind of special cases of this. So, example, Fermi function. So, what we know is that if we, meaning this is what I've been saying from, like, the beginning of the course, and saying that, well, just take my word for it, is that if you have a system of electrons in equilibrium with some levels like this, you know, say we consider a particular level with an energy epsilon, then the probability it is occupied will be given by the Fermi function. And what I claim is that that's not a new law. That just follows from here. In other words, if you knew this, that's really part of that. Okay? Now, let me show why. The way that would work is the following. You'd say, okay, let's think of this one level as my system and everything else as reservoir. And it's an equilibrium. So that one level, you could say, could be in one of two states. It could be empty or it could be full. So you could have one electron in there or you may have nothing in there. Now, you cannot do anything more because of the exclusion principle. In other words, you couldn't have two electrons in that state. And this is where, I guess, electrons are different from photons or light. Because photons, if you had a state with energy h nu, you could put 0, 1, 2, as many number of photons as you want. So that's what makes photons different. But let's do electrons first. So if you do electrons, you'd say, well, there's these two states. And each of these states has a certain E, EI. And the energy is epsilon, 0, n here is 1, 0. So the corresponding PI probability, according to that law, would be e to the power minus epsilon minus mu over kT. And here it would be, can you help me? So this over Z. And what is it for this state? Why? Because E is 0, n is also 0, so it's just exponential 0. But it's 1 over Z. Now, how do I find Z? Well, the point is those two things have to add up to 1. That's how I'd find Z. So if I add those things and equate it to 1, what do I get for Z? Just 1 plus that. Okay? So Z is equal to 1 plus e to the power minus x. I mean, let me just call this guy X, that whole thing. So So the probability that the state is empty then is 1 over z, which is basically 1 divided by 1 plus e to the power minus x. And the probability that it's full is e to the power minus x divided by 1 plus e to the power minus x. Right? And what is x? Well, x is where x is epsilon minus mu over kt. Right? That's it. So what that tells me is, given this state, the probability it is occupied is so much, probability is empty is so much. Now, how do I get the Fermi function out of that? Fermi function actually basically tells me the probability it's occupied. That's this one. And you can see this is really the Fermi function, you see, because this you could write as 1 divided by e to the power x plus 1. So it's the same thing really. See? So that's the Fermi function. And what you have here is really 1 minus f. That's the probability it's empty. So the point I'm trying to make is that the general rule is really this one. Applied to something with the exclusion principle, it comes out. Now, this is kind of important because, you see, this only applies when you have non-interacting things. So, for example, one of the things that come up is, what's the occupation of, say, donor levels in semiconductor devices? Now, you've probably seen this elsewhere, that when you have donor levels, usually it's not the Fermi function, but there's a half in there. Half meaning if there's these two states that are possible. And the reason is, the way you think about that is, you've got two levels there, but then the electrons are interacting. So it's very hard to put two electrons in there. But you could have one there. Now it's an interacting system. So you cannot apply Fermi functions directly. But what you can still do is apply this principle. You say that, well, we'll talk of the entire two-electron system, enumerate its energies, and apply that. And that's something we'll do next week. We'll talk about this general multi-electron picture. But the point I'm trying to make is this is the central law of equilibrium. This is the central law of equilibrium statistical mechanics. And if you take a course in statistical mechanics, as I said, you're either trying to understand where it came from or trying to use it for some real problems. Okay? Now, another version that you see often, another example of this that you see often, is the Bose-Einstein statistics, for example. That photons left to themselves, what is the distribution of photons? That number is actually, photon number is given by 1 divided by e to the power h nu over kt minus 1. And this is the important difference, of course. Instead of being plus 1, as in the Fermi function, the Bose function has a minus 1 there. But the point I want to make is that although this looks like a different function, it really again comes from here. This is the general rule. All follows from there. Okay. Now, in the case of photons, because photons are not conserved, so it's not like anytime a photon is emitted, something has to go out someplace else. Photons can be created just out of nothing. And so you don't have this mu factor involved. It's just energy involved. Although you could say particles are involved, but since those particles are not conserved, you don't need the mu. Otherwise, it's the same rule. Okay. Now, so the way you would apply this rule then is, you'd say that if I have a state, you know, a photon with energy h nu, you could either have no photons in there, or you could have one photon in there. And of course, if there was an exclusion principle for photons, it would have stopped right there. But photons don't have the exclusion principle. You can go on. You can put 2, 3, 4 up to infinity, any number you want. And the probability then that you'll have n photons will be given by e to the power minus h nu. Probability that you'll have n photons will be given by e to the power minus n h nu over kt. Divided by z. Because the energy of this is 0, energy of this is h nu, energy of this is 2h nu, 3h nu, etc. So you just write e to the power minus e over kt. So again, how do I find Z? Well, sum of all this has to be 1. So summation over NPN is equal to 1 over Z. So I'll call this X. And this is just a geometric series. So I think what you'll get is 1 n equals this divided by 1 minus e to the power minus x. So the probability of having n photons then will be e to the power minus nx divided by, did I get that right? Did I do that right? So, and we are setting this equal to 1. So that then gets you a Z. So this then gets you a probability of finding n photons. Now, how do I get this Bose number here? That's this one. Well, the thing is, it's not quite as simple as the Fermi case, because Fermi case, what happened was the 0 and 1. So we just looked at the probability of finding one electron and we're done. But here, if you really want the average number n, then what you should do is you should take sum over n, npn. So in other words, this tells you the probability of having n photons. And you multiply by n, and then you sum it all up, that will give you the average number. And the point is, if you go through that, it's a little more algebra, out of time, but if you go, it's a little more algebra and you'll get here. That's the one. See? So, at equilibrium then, when you're in equilibrium with the surroundings, this is what will tell you the average number of photons. Okay. But this basic principle still remains, that when you are trying to describe, say, the electron, in an electronic device where the electrons are able to, let's say, emit photons, that means give up energy to the photons, or are able to take in energy from the photons. So there will be something here and something here. And the ratio of these two would be always e to the power epsilon over kt, as long as that entity is in equilibrium. So for example, if we are talking of photons, what happens is the absorption process is proportional to n, which seems reasonable, that after what is the rate at which electrons can absorb energy from the photons? Well, depends on how many are there. If there's a lot of them, it accelerates the process. But what is not so intuitive is, this one, of course, has to be bigger than this, because we argued that always emission should be easier than absorption. And what you can show is that in order to get, you'll get the right ratio if here we put n plus 1. Because then you can see, if you take n plus 1 divided by n, you see that's the ratio of the emission rate to the absorption rate. That's equal to 1 plus 1 over n. And inverse of n is this quantity. And when I add 1 to it, you just get that. See? So this then becomes e to the power h nu over kt. You see? Like I had argued, that in general, for any reservoir at equilibrium, emission to absorption rate must be e to the power epsilon over kt. So if it is photons that are involved, this is how you'll get it. If it is electrons that are involved, then what would have happened is emission rate would have been 1 minus f, absorption rate would have been f, but then f's are given by the Fermi function, and what you can show is that will again get you e to the power epsilon minus mu over kt. That ratio will still be there. And all this, of course, applies as long as the reservoir is in equilibrium. And most of the time, what you assume when analyzing a device is that your surroundings are always kind of held in equilibrium. That's what you normally assume. But it doesn't have to be. In other words, there can be all kinds of interesting devices if the surroundings were actually out of equilibrium. So, for example, how does a solar cell work? Solar cell, I'd say, is, again, you have electrons which are interacting with light. And if the light was in equilibrium, with your device itself, nothing would have happened. I mean, you can show this would exactly cancel that, no current would flow at equilibrium. Why does it flow? Well, that's because the light is coming from the sun and it is distributed in the emission to absorption rate is given by this, where this KT is not the room temperature where your device is, but it's the temperature on the surface of the sun, or the, you know, what describes that radiation appropriately, which is more like, say, 6,000 Kelvin or so. I think that's the rough number. So while the electrons are distributed according to your room temperature, or, you know, whatever the device temperature is, the light itself is at some other temperature. And that's why you're having something interesting happen. Or you could try to make a laser, in which case, of course, you are trying to drive that photon system way out of equilibrium. You know, just as last day we were talking about how those spins, if you had started out in a special state, as you run this current, the state of the spin would keep changing. Now, in that case, you'll need a separate equation to describe how the entity changes and do it self-consistently with your device in that case. You know, so the whole process gets more complicated then. But in general, what you assume is that whatever entity you are interacting with is held in equilibrium by other forces. You know, just like these contacts, it's always held in equilibrium. That's what you normally assume. Okay, let me stop here. We'll continue.